in Bucharest, the capital of Romania, is one of the largest and most opulent palaces in all of the world. It has impressive gardens, it has immense banquet halls and ballrooms with huge chandeliers costing tens and tens of thousands of dollars, and specially custom woven carpets that match the decor. And it was exceptionally costly to build. Constructed in the 1980s, it consumed a significant percentage of the gross domestic product of the entire country of Romania, one of the poorer countries of the world. In fact, thousands of people were conscripted into working on that palace and forced to come from villages and towns and cities around Romania and live in Bucharest for months at a time so that they could build this private residence for the communist dictator Nicolae Ceausescu. When he chose the site for the palace, it was a place that was inhabited by the poor people of Bucharest. And he ordered that their homes be taken away from them, that the houses be torn down, the church buildings removed, the businesses eliminated, so that he could have the place for his palace. But even after all of that was done, within sight of the palace were the homes of the poor. And so he ordered that a facade be built that would depict lovely housing and other buildings so that from the palace he would look on that which was pleasant. I've been there. I've driven behind those facades where there's nothing. There are no buildings. It just looks good from the one side and hides the sights of poverty. For you see, it can be an unpleasant thing to see the suffering of others. When we're healthy, a lot of us don't like to be around those who are sick. And when we are rich, we have sometimes a tendency to avoid association with anyone who is poor. Even when we are young, we may avoid being for very long around those who are very old, perhaps reminding us of our own mortality. And when we are comfortable, frankly, we just don't like to be with people who are uncomfortable, and especially those who are in pain. Jesus told a story. It is a pointed and powerful story that is uncomfortable. It is a parable, not history. It is a story that Jesus made up in order to communicate important truths, but this particular parable is unlike all of the other parables, the many parables which Jesus taught. For it is the only parable of Jesus that uses a person's name. It is about a poor man, and somehow the face of poverty is too often anonymous. And so Jesus made an exception to his usual teaching practice, and he assigned a name to this man, for he did not want us to somehow escape the personal connection with the man who was so poor, called Lazarus. You can listen to the story yourself. It's on page 1626 of the Blue Pew Bible, or in Luke 16, verses 19 to 31. There was a rich man who was dressed in purple and fine linen and lived in luxury every day. At his gate was laid a beggar named Lazarus, covered with sores. Covered with sores and longing to eat what fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs came and licked his sores. The time came when the beggar died, and the angels carried him to Abraham's side. The rich man also died and was buried. In hell, where he was in torment, he looked up and saw Abraham far away with Lazarus by his side. So he called to him, "Father Abraham, have pity on me and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, because I am in agony in this fire." But Abraham replied, "Son, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things, while Lazarus received bad things. But now he is comforted here, and you are in agony. And besides all this, between us and you, a great chasm has been fixed, so that those who want to go from here to you cannot, nor can anyone cross over from there to us. He answered, Then I beg you, Father, send Lazarus to my father's house, for I have five brothers. Let him warn them so that they will not also come to this place of torment. Abraham replied, They have Moses and the prophets. Let them listen to them. No, Father Abraham, he said, but if someone from the dead goes to them, they will repent. He said to him, If they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not be convinced even if someone rises from the dead. Jesus told this story almost as if he expected it to become a stage play with two scenes. Scene one is now, the present. The place is in and around the home of a very rich man. Scene number two is later, and the place is on either side of the line between heaven and hell. Jesus says that there was a rich man who was dressed in purple and fine linen and lived in luxury every day. His name is not given, and that is something of a surprise because usually we know the names of those who are rich, whereas poverty remains anonymous. If I were to give you a pop quiz this morning and ask you to write down one of the names of the 20 richest people in America, my guess is almost everyone in this room would get at least one of them. Whereas by contrast, if I were to ask for us to write down one of the 20 names of the poorest people in America, I would be amazed if any of us got one of the names. But not so in Jesus' story. In Jesus' story, the poor man is known by name, and the rich man is known by wealth. It is an interesting contrast. This very rich man wore very expensive clothes, made out of purple cloth, which was very expensive. The purple dye was very costly, and made of fine linen. It's kind of difficult to estimate exactly what the value would be at such a distant point in history and in a different economy. But if we were to take the wages of the typical worker for a year, we know that that would be barely enough or probably not enough to buy one outfit for this very rich man. So we may surmise that he dressed not for warmth and not for comfort, not for modesty, but to show off how wealthy he was. He was, in modern terms, an example of conspicuous consumption. He wanted everyone to see the wealth that he had. And we are told that he lived in luxury every day. Actually, in the words that Jesus originally spoke, we might better translate and say that he feasted daily. And it is a picture of going to a smorgasbord of exotic gourmet food, the kind of smorgasbord that you might experience once a year, maybe once in a lifetime. Except this was his daily fare. Every meal was like this, the very best of the very best of food. So simply stated, he was at the very top end of the socioeconomic ladder. He was very, very wealthy, and he lived out the lifestyle of the rich and the famous. Now, Jesus does not criticize his wealth. Jesus does not condemn him for his lifestyle. And he could have. And probably there are some people who would say that Jesus should have criticized him. But he didn't. Because that wasn't the point that Jesus was seeking to make. The point that he was seeking to make was about the relationship of this very rich man to his poor neighbor Lazarus. For at his gate was laid a beggar named Lazarus, covered with sores and longing to eat what fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs came and licked his sores. Now, there's no explanation given of why one man is so rich and the other man is so poor, and we might want to guess. I mean, typically, we would want to ask questions like, did this rich guy work very hard, save a lot, and invest wisely, where by contrast, the poor man was lazy and a spendthrift? Or could it be that the very rich man inherited his money? He was born to wealth. By contrast, Lazarus was born to poverty. He never, ever in his life was around very much money. But Jesus doesn't say. So our curiosity is not satisfied, and it may not seem very important. For Jesus picks up the story simply acknowledging that this was the way things were, and then talking about what happened. Lazarus is actually a Latin form of a Hebrew name. If Jesus were here and were speaking in his native language, he probably wouldn't have said Lazarus. He would have said Eliezer. It was a common name. There are others with the name of Eliezer or Lazarus within the Bible. It is a Hebrew word that means God is my help. A lovely name. God is my help. Except for Lazarus, must not have thought that God was much help at all. Where was God to help him when his stomach was rumbling and bloating with hunger? Where was this helpful God when his limbs were atrophying and his muscles were so thin that he could barely move his arms and legs? Where was this helpful God when the sores were ulcerating from head to toe and he was so weak that he couldn't chase off the dogs that came to lick his legs and arms? Homeless, helpless, hungry. Lazarus has one thing on his mind, and that is that he yearns for the scraps that fall from the rich man's gourmet table. In those days, they didn't eat with knives and forks as we do today. They ate with their hands. They picked up the food with their fingers and put it in their mouths. Actually, there are parts of the world where that is the case today. If you were to visit Bangladesh, you would see that people with their right hands would eat in much the same fashion as they did in Jesus' day. In fact, even the very rich people ate with their hands, which meant, of course, that the food was all over their fingers and that their fingers became sticky, and they needed a way to wipe off their hands. And so what they would do is reach for the abundance of bread that was available at their tables, tear the loaves open, and then use the bread to wipe off their fingers. So they could actually thrust their fingers into the soft part of the bread, and then their fingers having been cleaned, they'd throw the bread away. And that was the bread that Lazarus hoped to eat. It was not only the filling of the bread, but there would be the slight taste from what had been wiped off the rich man's fingers, the slight nutrition, maybe the little protein that he would be able to get. It is a portrait of extremes. The richest of the rich and the poorest of the poor, the heights of luxury and the depths of misery. The sin of the rich man was not that he was rich. It was not that he withheld food from the poor. There isn't any indication that he would not allow this bread to be given to Lazarus. He didn't chase Lazarus away from his gate. He could have, but he didn't. And he was not responsible in the sense that he caused the poverty of Lazarus, and certainly he is not the one who made him sick in the first place. So the rich man did nothing wrong. Nothing wrong. And that's the whole point. The rich man did nothing. His sin was that he didn't care. If he were here today, perhaps he would not even know a poor person by name. If he were here today, perhaps he would drive his car through a poor section of the city or through some poor community. And when the traffic would slow him down and his mind would wander off the pressing business of the day, he would notice and think to himself, or perhaps comment to another passenger in the car, "Isn't it interesting that where these poor people live in their houses and their apartments, that there are always television antennas on tops of the buildings?" And he would mention that when at night you glance through the unshaded window of a poor home, you can see the flicker of a color television set. So they must not be very poor after all. Except He doesn't realize that in that home there are children who are hungry, and there is no food for them in the kitchen. He thinks nothing of the fact that they don't have health insurance, and they cannot get the care that they need. It doesn't occur to him that there are people in that home who work as many or more hours per week than he works per week, but that the wages are so low that it's not enough money to pay the rent and to feed the children. It's not something that crosses his mind that those are parents who are afraid to send their children to school for fear of what will there happen to them, or that the schools don't have enough money to provide all of the tools that are necessary for a good education. He just doesn't notice. He just doesn't care. He does nothing. Jesus' second scene is later. Both men are now dead, for death is not a respecter of wealth, and no one's riches exempts that person from the grave. Sooner or later, we all die. When the Bible was written, the word that was used was the word Hades. It is only later editors and translators of the Bible that chose to substitute the word hell. Hades referred to the grave, to death, to the dead. Death is divided into two parts. One is the place of torment for the unrighteous, and the other is the place of pleasure for the righteous. In Jesus' second scene, the roles are completely reversed from scene number one. Now the rich man who lived in luxury is in misery. He's poor and he's pathetic and he's in constant pain. And the great desire of his heart is that someone be sent with a drop of water hanging from a fingertip that could be placed at the edge of his tongue so that for a split second he might have a slight relief from his misery. Now this once rich man sees everything differently. Now he knows Lazarus by name. Now he wants to have a connection with his former neighbor. So he calls out, but Lazarus does not answer him. Instead, it is Abraham who speaks. Abraham, the father of the Jewish people. And he explains that now it's too late. That Lazarus can't help him. That their destinies after death were fixed before they died. It's too late. And so the once rich man makes a second request. Not for himself, but for his five brothers who are back at home in their father's house. Send Lazarus to my father's house. Let him warn them. But Abraham explains they've been warned. They've been warned by the Bible. They've been warned by Moses and the other prophets, and they wouldn't listen. And if somehow there were a way to send Lazarus back and to say what it was like, they wouldn't listen to him either. Now, in sharpest contrast, in this second scene, is Lazarus, who once was poor and who now lives in luxury, who is now far better off than he ever was, who now wouldn't go back even if he were given the offer because he is with Abraham, the father of the faith. And apparently, Lazarus can't even hear the calls that come from the agonized, once rich neighbor. Apparently, he doesn't even know what happened to this man whose house he outside of which he once lived. Lazarus, who was sick, is now well. Lazarus, who was miserable, is now comfortable. Lazarus, who once only had dogs from the street as his friends, now is the friend of Abraham himself. Lazarus, who once lived in misery, lives in luxury. Listen to Jesus again. The time came when the beggar died and the angels carried him to Abraham's side. The rich man also died and was buried. In hell, where he was in torment, he looked up and saw Abraham far away with Lazarus by his side. So he called to him, Father Abraham, have pity on me and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue because I am in agony in this fire. But Abraham replied, Son, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things while Lazarus receive bad things. But now he is comforted here, and you are in agony. And besides all this, between us and you, a great chasm has been fixed so that those who want to go from here to you cannot, nor can anyone cross from there to us. He answered, "Then I beg you, Father, send Lazarus to my father's house, for I have five brothers. Let him warn them so that they will not also come to this place of torment." Abraham replied, "They have Moses and the prophets. Let them listen to them." "No, Father Abraham," he said, "but if someone from the dead goes to them, they will repent." He said to him, "If they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not be convinced even if someone rises from the dead." I read and I reread and I reread this story of Jesus. And I'm in it. And I'm the rich man. I'm the rich man who has so much and for whom it is so easy to ignore those who have so little. There are lessons. Lessons here for me to hear. Perhaps lessons for you to hear. Jesus' story makes those lessons so obvious that they need little or no explanation. Lesson one is to have personal concern for others. For others who are hungry, for others who are poor, for others who are disabled, for others who are sick and needy. Have personal concern for others. Lesson number two is that today connects to eternity. That our eternal destiny is set in this life. That there's a connection between today and forever. Lesson number three, that we already have adequate warning of what to expect. That from the Bible we have all of the information that we need on how to live life now and how to prepare for eternity. And lesson number four is to love your neighbor. Know his name. See her need. Help them out. I love to end a sermon with a story. A story that illustrates in real life the teachings that come from Jesus. And I have a really good story for you this morning. Except instead of me telling it, listen to it from someone who was actually there. This morning's faith story from Jan Hultgren.